special meeting at the San Juan County Public Hospital District Number 1.
Is now joining.
Board of Commissioners meeting. It's Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. This is a remotely held meeting held under COVID-19 emergency rules. It's 5:30 p.m. Let's see, and we would like to let Marianne start, I think. I mean, I have, Nathan, do you want me to read all of this stuff? I'm sorry. It's just our remotely, I'll just recap. This is our first entirely remote meeting. It's April 8th, the time is 5:30. This is to replace a meeting that we had to cancel on the 25th due to the governor's orders. So it's to replace our regular meeting from March. The proclamation 2028 issued on the 24th temporarily prohibited public agencies from conducting any in-person meetings and requires all remote meetings to provide an option for the public attendance via remote access to the public.
And is now joining.
Usually we're not allowed to meet this way, at this time, it's the only way we're permitted to meet. So during this time, agencies are prohibited from taking action as defined in RCW 4230-0203, unless those matters are necessary and routine matters or are matters necessary to respond to the COVID-19 outbreak and the current public health emergency. This is a special meeting and actions will be taken constrained to the agenda. Board members and meeting participants are attending via Microsoft Teams, I believe, some with video and some with cloud, while all members of the public are participating by phone. In order to ensure audio quality is good, most participants are muted. For this reason, it's important to please contact Nathan if you wish to make a statement during the audience participation or send your statement by email to butler@sjcphd1.org. Include the number you are calling from if you wish to make a statement so that he can unmute you. There will be two audience participation sections, one after the outside report and one at the end. Please be patient as this is our first remote meeting. We will not be able to offer technical help if you cannot connect, but we do plan to post audio and perhaps video of the meeting afterwards. We are learning along with everyone else how this all works. For the purposes of record keeping, we need to do a verbal roll call. And Board Recording Secretary Nathan Butler will read each person's name. Please state that you are here for the record.
Okay. We'll just do this in order of by alphabetically. So, Commissioner Clary.
Present.
Commissioner Lehman.
Sorry, no? Are you here?
Commissioner Lehman, you might have to unmute your microphone. Okay, for the record, she is here. Okay, Commissioner Lindstrom is here. Commissioner Lachine Seitz. Okay, and Commissioner Loring.
Here.
Thank you.
I did hear Kyle Dodd join the meeting as well.
Kyle, thanks for being here.
If everybody can mute their mics if they're not talking, that would be great. There's a lot of ambient noise with all of our participants, including our guests, our visitors.
So, Marianne, can you hear all of us?
I can, but there is a lot of ambient noise.
I think we'd like to start with Marianne. I understand you have some time limitations. So I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you so much. So, commissioners, I would like to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to address COVID-19 preparedness care at Peace Health Keys Island Medical Center. The COVID-19 pandemic has rapidly changed the world around us, and it's understandable to find it all unsettling and concerning. First and foremost, I'd like to acknowledge our caregivers and our physicians, both at the bedside and behind the scenes, leading COVID-19 planning and preparedness, for their courage.
Susan Williamson is now joining.
And their professionalism, even in times of great hardship. They are the true healthcare heroes dedicated to serving our community. Planning for this healthcare crisis remains a dynamic process. Recommendations, guidelines, and practices change daily as new information is discovered about the COVID-19 virus. Here are some of the steps we've taken to ensure that we are protecting our community while preparing to meet
Susan Williamson is now exiting.
Surge in COVID-19 patients. We've implemented practices to reduce the risk of transmission for caregivers and community, including visitor restrictions, symptom screening, and universal masking. We've added mobile screening and televisits. We've prepared an external triage site, and we've readied internal areas for patient overflow. And we've canceled or postponed elective procedures. Peak Health continues to implement a personal protective equipment, PPE, conservation plan to ensure that we're adequately stocked with PPE, and our system supply chain team continues to identify and enter into purchasing contracts with reputable supply manufacturers around the globe to ensure we have what we need. And I must mention the donations of hand
sanitizer is now joining.
And other items received by our generous community and how these have assisted with our planning efforts. We remain hopeful that our efforts and these implemented statewide are impactful at reducing the spread of coronavirus. We value the trust you place in us to navigate these challenging times, and we are honored to care for this community. Now I'd like to move into questions that have been forwarded by the commissioners. One of the questions, does PIMC foresee limitations on treating non-COVID-19 patients, such as those presenting at the emergency department, if local COVID-19 cases increase? We do not foresee an issue or limitations treating patients in our emergency department at Peace Health Peace Island. Peace Island and our experienced clinical staff is fully prepared to triage and care for patients at our medical center, EB. And our inpatient unit, should patients require general, urgent, or hospitalized care related or unrelated to COVID-19? Two, how many COVID-19 patients can the hospital treat on site? We have 10 inpatient beds and 5 emergency room bays. Are all of them are able to accept patients with COVID-19? Are there circumstances in which a San Juan Island patient would be transferred off-island for treatment of COVID-19 symptoms? What are they? If there were a queue for treatment at the off-island facility, where would an island patient be placed in that queue? The answer to that is yes. Peace Health Peace Island does not have an ICU. So a patient requiring ICU-level care would be transferred to a hospital able to provide that higher level of care as available. We have planned collaboratively with our Peace Health Lower Northwest Network to transfer care to our sister facility, St. Joseph Medical Center, for patients who need higher levels of care for more acute symptoms, specifically ventilatory support. Four, what steps are being taken by PIMC to increase testing capacity? This has been ongoing around the nation. Currently, in the last week, we've added drive-up testing for our clinic patients that meet CDC requirements for testing after a telephone screening with a PHMG clinic provider. We've also increased our testing capabilities to include symptomatic patients with 2 of 3 of the following conditions: fever, cough, shortness of breath, and a high-risk underlying condition. This has expanded our testing capability to not just include healthcare workers, including public safety occupations such as fire and EMS, but also patients from a facility or an institution, as well as pregnant women. Additionally, we have the capability to implement point-of-care testing. We've received that machine in our building, and we will be able to do that in our medical center by the end of this week with a 5 to 15 minute turnaround time for test results. That will be for inpatients. We continue to prepare to care for our community in this worldwide pandemic. As testing capabilities increase and as test materials become available, we will continue to expand our testing. However, we are still unable to offer universal testing for asymptomatic patients. 5. How is PIMC communicating internally with medical providers to ensure that they feel supported and to make sure that PIMC can get the information it needs to provide that support? We're doing a lot of communication. So daily updates are provided by our network, a chief operating officer, and PIMC's chief medical officer. Dr. Michael Sullivan also provides regular updates as the ED medical director to the physicians about any local clinical changes. Daily updates are provided in the emergency department to our entire clinical staff. The Peace Health Northwest Network also provides a daily update to all of our caregivers via email and through our internal intranet called Crossroads. A daily message is also sent to medical providers as well to help them stay informed with rapid changes in testing, care, and new recommendations from the CDC, Department of Health, and system medical and infection prevention leaders. Links are provided to updated content so providers can access this information at any time during the day or night through their computers or devices. We continue to encourage our staff to openly share their concerns, fears, etc., with their supervisors so we can address them proactively and resolve them promptly. Next. Under what circumstances would PIMC or a contractor terminate the services of a doctor here who has expressed concern about preparation for a COVID-19 response? Well, Peace Health greatly values open communication with its caregivers and physicians. We appreciate many of them have concerns related to COVID-19 preparation. Communication with our caregivers is supported through challenge panels that promote respectful, professional, and honest dialogue. We rely on their feedback to help us guide and shape our culture and emphasize its importance within Peace Health. Peace Health would not terminate the services of a doctor or any caregiver
Dr.
who expresses concerns about preparations for COVID-19
now joining.
Or any other crisis response. 7. I wanted to ask for a general update and overview of what preparations PIMC has made to care for COVID patients and what outside agencies they're collaborating with. So PIMC is working with EMS, the County Health Department, private healthcare providers, and the EOC as we all work to provide care for our community in this worldwide pandemic. In addition, the PIMC Incident Command Team is working with the Peace Health System Command Team to escalate any needs and remain focused on preparations. What is the cost for a COVID test at PIMC for insured and uninsured? Is this an expense that PIMC or the patient will be reimbursed for by the state or federal government? A COVID-19 test costs $103. It's the same for insured or uninsured patients. Patients may still qualify for our financial assistance policy. As for reimbursements, we still can't speak to state or federal reimbursement. Given the national scale of the disaster, FEMA rules can be subject to change, and currently the guidelines on FEMA.gov are generic to normal disasters. 9. Have you worked to maintain a functional healthcare system during this? The answer to this is yes. Our clinic is currently using televisits through the phone, and they will be implementing video telemedicine next week. 10. Is there a designated area in the clinic for treating patients that have acute respiratory symptoms? And how is PIMC isolating patients and protecting staff? So we are screening staff and visitors as they enter the building. We're utilizing temperature checks, and we're continuing to follow CDC recommendations to reduce risk for patients, caregivers, and visitors. waiting area in both the clinic and the emergency department for patients experiencing respiratory symptoms. In the clinic area, though, I'd just like to point out, if someone had acute respiratory symptoms, they would be sent to the emergency department. 11, is there an outside triage for the emergency department? The answer to that is yes. We have placed a triage unit, it's the trailer, near the emergency department. Should volumes increase, we'll open this unit to provide care. However, our ED volumes are manageable presently, and we have not had to implement the use of the trailer. We are seeing this trend across other locations in the Pacific Northwest. Trailers that have been implemented as part of surge planning are not currently as used as patient volumes don't support their use. 12, is drive-through testing being utilized? Mobile testing began last week through the medical group clinic. Again, limited to the previous scope of patients that I mentioned, anyone who meets that criteria for testing, and to support social distancing, a telephone screening with the clinic provider is required first, and it is by appointment. 13, are home assessment teams being created, perhaps in collaboration with community care medicine, to unburden the ED? First, as I mentioned with the triage trailer, our ED is not currently burdened. In fact, our volumes are down. As people continue to practice social distancing and limit activity to prevent community spread of COVID-19, we have capacity to care for those who need care and aren't in a situation like other hospitals nationwide. Home assessment teams, though, are a good way to check on homebound seniors and others in our community, and we do support that practice. The HAT teams have not yet been established in our county, but we do continue to explore the option in collaboration with the county health officer. And I believe that concludes the questions that were submitted by the commissioners. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. Can I ask anybody on the call that does not have their microphone muted to please mute their microphone? Thank you. So thanks so much for that update, Marianne. We really appreciate you taking time to communicate with us and all the work you're doing to take care of our community. I wanted to open this up to the other commissioners if they had any follow-up comments or questions based on what they just heard you say.
This is Trish Lehman. Hi, Marianne. And the question I had is, it sounds, what I'm understanding is that an individual to be tested at Peace Island has to be a Peace Island patient. Is that correct?
For the drive-up testing, Trish.
So, so someone that wasn't a patient could be tested at Peace Island, that it hadn't had a former relationship?
Not through our drive-up testing. That does involve a provider screening.
Okay. So as long as they came in and saw the provider and became a patient, then they could be tested.
If they met the criteria. Again, we're
right.
Not...
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that right. Is correct. That is correct.
Okay.
And generally, our providers are doing phone screens, but if it's a new patient, yes, they would need to be seen.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think the other, I'm just going to ask one other question, Marianne. Again, it's Trish Lehman. We're not seeing the increase in patients, and thank goodness, but if there was, say, there was a big bloom, and we saw, and there were more than 14 patients that needed to have care in a hospital. What's the
unknown participant is now joining?
Other, areas that you could set up cots and that sort of thing. Is that within the hospital, or would that be like at the convalescent center building? Or I was just wondering what that plan was.
Right. So the hospital would only keep hospital-appropriate patients. We have worked Frank James about what patients who didn't require hospital care, and that would be part of the EOC plan. In terms of patients who required hospital care, we would still use our normal process if we didn't have beds and transfer to another site. And we've been fortunate, as you've said, we haven't seen the volume of patients that other communities have seen. And our sister hospitals do have beds available and would be available to accept our patients.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, if there's nothing else, I will let you go, Marianne. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you. If I can just say, actually, thank you to the whole community, and just say it on the record, that everyone maintaining social distancing is making a difference. And thank you all for doing your part. I really appreciate it because it's keeping you all healthy and keeping you out of the building. So wash your hands and stay safe.
Thank you, you too.
Is now joining.
Okay, so I think next we're...
Unknown participant is now exiting.
We will hear from Kyle Dodd. Kyle, are you with us?
I am, thank you.
Hi, thanks for taking the time to join us. I'm sure you're very busy. You are the San Juan County Emergency Operations Center representative, and we were hoping to have an update from you.
You betcha. So, Kyle Dodd, my day job is Environmental Health Manager, San Juan County Health and Community Services. Since March 3rd, I have been serving as the incident commander as part of the county's response out of the Emergency Operations Center. A little bit of history. So we started planning as a department, that would be Health and Community Services, the third week of January, shortly after the first case in the United States was confirmed in Snohomish County, wanting to be prepared since that was that's very close to our county. So we were planning at a lower level than we certainly are now within our department. Governor issued a state of emergency for Washington on February 29th, and we decided to expand our response for the county. So again, on March 3rd, we opened up the Emergency Operations Center in conjunction with our emergency manager, Brendan Cowan. And that includes a list of about almost 60 folks that are routinely on our morning briefing calls, ranging from county staff across several departments to partner agencies like San Juan Island EMS, and the public hospital district. So we're very fortunate that we have a team of dedicated professionals that are working side by side to support our community in this. Just to touch on a couple of response efforts. So certainly our public information and outreach section is very strong. I hope a lot of you are able to follow our Facebook messaging and website updates. We have hot topics and videos that have been very popular. So we're doing a lot on messaging. Our response in that area has been more robust, as it should be, than it ever has been. A couple things that that went out over last week was a urging of visitors to stay away. So you're all familiar with the governor's stay home, stay healthy order that was just extended to May 4th. Our county health officer also issued an order to close down transient accommodations for any purpose other than essential. Planned on coming out to San Juan Island to kind of hunker down and get away from the cases that were happening elsewhere in the state, that we could limit that by not having any place for them to stay as far as transient accommodations like hotels, B&Bs, and so forth. So our health officer issued that order, and we have also been very concerned about just travel off island in general. So health officer was considering his options around a required quarantine for anybody that traveled off island or came here from the mainland, and that became problematic to implement. So again, we landed on a more strong message from county leaders to urge folks to stay home and abide by the governor's order and effectively limit their travel out here. Where we're at currently with cases is we are holding at 12 cases in the county, and in response to a confirmed case, we have a very defined follow-up process that's carried out by our surveillance and contact tracing group. So we have a team of six nurses providing 24/7 coverage available to follow up on reports of positive tests, and also the necessary interviews of contacts of those positive cases to be able to limit the spread of disease in the community once those cases are identified. We're also in touch with medical providers daily, tracking the number of total tests that are performed, and ensuring that information is being handed out to those patients when they're tested, that they need to be isolating until they get test results back. So again, a lot of hard work around that surveillance and contact tracing, and as it turns out, the joke around the office is if something's going to happen, it's going to happen at Friday at 5 o'clock, and this last weekend, they had another positive case that we were notified of Friday night that they were following up on, and then two more on Saturday. So I can't speak highly enough of that group doing the work that they're doing to again identify those contacts and limit their movement in the community and follow up to ensure that these positive cases that we're seeing don't turn into 4, 5, or 6 for every case. We have a liaison group, and that group out of the EOC is performing outreach to over 150 organizations countywide. So our stores, our libraries, our schools, local businesses. So we have partner calls that are scheduled every week, providing updates on the response and answering questions that come up mainly around the latest are around, am I an essential business and what can I do, or I'm concerned about the financial impacts. So we have information regarding small business administration and some of the other resources that the governor has pulled together, and also forward folks to the EDC as well locally for that. A other operational efforts, we have a vulnerable population group and a system in place. Once the county senior centers close down, our group is replacing the Meals on Wheels, so those folks don't have to go without those vital nutrition meals. And our, the number has quadrupled since the close of those centers, and other folks have been identified as needing to take advantage of that. Also, our Senior Services Division and the County Resource Centers are identifying other vulnerable populations through an intake form that can be turned in either through the Resource Centers or the Senior Centers. And so if there is a need identified in the county, maybe somebody needs groceries or their household essentials, there is no age qualification for that. They don't have to be a senior to qualify. That group is currently meeting the needs of 165 people countywide for, again, those items that they can't get out and about and obtain. We've done a lot of planning around medical surge. So, again, the worst case scenario would be that all the hospitals that we would typically transport patients to from the island are dealing with their own either COVID patients or other patients, and there is no availability for any patients from San Juan County to be transported off-island as is customary. So that surge planning group was looking at, okay, if that were the case, what would we need to set up to be able to provide basic care for those individuals until a bed at another hospital freed up and we could fly those people off. So there are plans in place and facilities identified, San Juan, Orcas, and Lopez, and we are currently negotiating agreements with those facilities and getting right up to the point where we're identifying resources, and then we're gonna hit the pause button there. The reason why is because the modeling. And Marianne touched on it a little bit in her presentation. The modeling out of the University of Washington indicates that both emergency department visits are down, and also the hospital resources necessary to care for COVID patients will not be exceeded by the number of patients. Again, this is modeling. And that's corroborated with what we're hearing across the region. We do get reports from the Northwest Healthcare Network regarding ED visits and beds available. So again, all the messaging is pointing to the fact that Washington State being so proactive with the social distancing piece and all of our citizens that are taking that seriously has really created a scenario where our medical system, including both EMS and hospitals and healthcare providers, are not being overwhelmed at this time with patients. So we said at the beginning with that whole surge piece that our goal is to identify where we would set it up and how we would, what supplies we would need, where we'd get those supplies, and how we would staff it. The goal was never that we want to set one of these up. Again, that would be an absolute worst case scenario if we were having to care for folks that outside of a medical facility because there was no place available to accept them. We're also working on isolation and quarantine facilities. So there was a grant through the Department of Commerce to provide funding to counties that were establishing rooms for, these would be individuals that were required to either isolate or quarantine at home, and they were either homeless or at risk of homelessness if they had to do that. So we've identified the number of rooms that we're trying to secure countywide and are working on agreements with facilities, again, on San Juan, Orcas, and Lopez to have those rooms available. The testing piece. So medical providers are currently testing. And again, to piggyback on Marianne's comments, the testing supplies are not readily available in quantities that would allow for the broad-scale population to be tested. Because of that, the State Department of Health has prioritized testing for those that are at highest risk for dying due to COVID, for those that are frontline workers like medical providers or EMS. So, again, ideally, there is broad-scale support for testing. We all understand that we need to get there, but with the limited number of responder needed to get tested, that those test kits are available. And again, that prioritization comes to us from the State Department of Health. We are working on a plan to provide additional testing, and that may look like a medical team international van that travels out to our county and sets up and helps to augment testing at the local clinics, or it may be something like a drive-through testing facility like we're seeing in other counties. We have ordered additional test kits through the State Emergency Operations Center, but until we get those, we won't be in a position where we can support providers to open up their testing to that broader community. Personal protective equipment has also been a focus of our group, and we have heard from some medical providers and first responders that they are starting to run low. We have a small cache in the county, mainly N95 masks that were distributed to counties during the H1N1 response, that those masks that were distributed nationwide are technically expired, but they have been tested by the CDC, and they have determined their efficacy and are recommending distribution of those. So we have made those supplies available to our local partners that are running low, and again, still encouraging them to continue with their normal supply chains. But again, as all of you are likely well aware, the supply chain for PPE is very difficult. The domestic orders are being cross-bid, and everybody's competing for those. And now folks are turning to China, trying to get direct from manufacturer orders there. Our order for personal protective equipment through the State Emergency Operations Center, part of that was fulfilled yesterday, but we did not get any N95 masks. We also got approval from the county council to continue pursuing a larger scale PPE purchase as well. But I'm reassured that the State Emergency Operations Center has increased their spending for personal protective equipment. They were at around $30 million last week, and they've increased that by over $100 million. They're up to $145 million trying to obtain both N95s and other PPE for this state dispersing that to medical facilities and counties that have requested. I think a couple of last things I'll touch on, and then I'll stop my rambling and allow you guys to ask any questions you may have. We understand that there isn't one sector of our county that has not been affected by this. And I touched a little bit on the Small Business Administration loans, but another part of the response that we're looking at is supporting those small businesses and, again, directing folks to the Economic Development Council and also making folks aware of the all the resources out there from the governor, ensuring that we have pushed out additional emergency rental assistance funds to the family resource centers. I know the governor has done a lot of work around stays of eviction during this time, realizing that a lot of folks in our service industry are going to have a hard time making mortgage and rent payments. So we're trying to augment that work as well. And then finally, the behavioral health piece. So we have a relatively new staff person to health and community services that comes from the behavioral health community, and he has been plugged in as a liaison out of the Emergency Operations Center, working to identify all the available resources in the community, and then any gaps or needs, and then coming up with a plan to ensure that that those needs are met. So I've done a lot of talking. I've touched on a lot of things, and I would certainly welcome any questions and go from there.
Thank you so much, Kyle. I know you've been at this probably since early this morning because you had a meeting, but I do appreciate you taking the time to be here, and it's great to hear just a comprehensive report on all the planning and the work that you all have been doing. Thank you. I'll open it up to any other commissioner for any questions at this time.
I do have a question. This is Everett Clary. I'm actually interested in what you worry about the most.
He's now exiting.
What you think is the biggest problem on the horizon?
That's a very good question. If you would have asked me a couple weeks ago, the medical surge is the one that kept me up at night. Again, we were planning and had to consider worst case scenario that we wouldn't be able to transport patients off the island. I'm now very hopeful around that, again, given the modeling and the fact that there appears to be adequate capacity. Since you asked me that today, however, though, I would say that our biggest risk is still the transport of the illness from folks that are traveling off island or coming out here for essential business and essential activities. So the more messaging we get out there about folks to try and hunker down, and those county residents that go off island, be extremely careful, practice good hygiene, social distance, and when you get back, if you have the ability to self-quarantine, please do that, because again, that's how the cases will make it here, as if they are. So far, we've seen limited person-to-person spread amongst the cases that we have. Again, the highest risk is those coming from off-island. So I don't know if that answered your question. That was more of an opinion that I wasn't expecting, but I appreciate that question for sure.
No, that that's exactly what I wanted, because that it's hard for somebody to guess. You know better than anybody what the next problem is.
This is Trish Lehman. Am I on? Let's see. Okay, good. Kyle, one of my questions is about people coming from off-island. I did go on a walk up Roche Harbor area yesterday, and I saw construction crews building up there, the houses that are up behind the Hotel de Haro. And there certainly was no social distancing going on amongst the workers. And that was a little troubling, because I'm thinking, I'm not so sure that those are essential buildings. So it's like, are there any people that are doing compliance? I just saw a neighbor that had some new appliances delivered by a mainland company. And, you know, I'm just curious, because I know these folks must be coming on, you know, to the island. And it, you know, is how... Is it just social pressure that we're supposed to exert on others, or is there any kind of a compliance, I don't want to say officer, but like, you know, I know it's a difficult subject.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That's a very good question, and one that our public information team and our liaison have fielded many questions around. How do we enforce that governor's proclamation around the stay home, stay healthy? There is an enforcement piece to that, and there is an online form to fill out to report cases of that, and that's through, don't have that off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that emailed to Nathan. That's from the governor's website. So they want to know about specifically businesses that folks are questioning whether should they be open or should they not. So there is a there's a process where if it's a business that is regulated by county are still working through, but until we can reach out to all those folks, we're asking everybody that we message to that if you see something like that and you feel comfortable, just educating folks around that and pointing them to the resources. We're asking folks to do that as well, but there is an enforcement mechanism. It's not going to be everywhere, but we're hoping with that combined with the messaging that we're putting out there, and also the messaging that's now at the on the ferry booths and on the boats regarding travel is cutting down on that as well. We are told that the ferry booth workers are not going to be gatekeepers. They're not going to put themselves in that position. So we're left with just the signage, the messaging. Again, local law enforcement have received several calls and have followed up, and I know that we've messaged directly to folks as well. So there's a little bit of everything going on there, but I understand that that there are new concerns every day that pop up. So.
Thank you.
Is there anything else for our incident commander? Okay. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you very much. We will release you. We appreciate you spending time with us this evening.
All right. Thank you all for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kyle.
Keep calling.
Is now exiting.
So we are now to audience.
Kyle Dodd.
Is now exiting.
Sorry. We are now to audience participation. And so, Nathan, do we have Anyone that wishes
unknown participant is now exiting.
Yes, I believe we had one person who wanted to perhaps make a comment. Let's see, Karin, Augusta, did you want to make a comment? I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Nathan. Only at the end of this meeting, if I still need to, I need to hear what gets said as you go through the various agenda items before I have anything real to say. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Karin. I think that was the only comment, Commissioner.
Okay, great. And there wasn't anything emailed in or anything to read into the record?
No, no.
Okay.
If there are any, people can email them in during the meeting. I'm in my office again, and I'm enjoying the luxury of having multiple screens again. So yeah, you can actually email me during the meeting, those of you that are listening, and I will have them at the end.
Okay, great. So we have to go ahead and approve our consent agenda, everyone. And so voting this way is a little bit of a challenge. So I'm going to call on each of you in alphabetical order to state yes or no to the motion or resolution. And as far as signatures,
Dr. Mark Fish out.
Is now exiting.
The auditor has instructed us to have each commissioner just send an email to the board recording secretary, that would be Nathan, as a digital signature in this case until we can actually physically sign paper again.
So, unknown participant is now joining.
I'm sorry if I sound halting. I keep hearing people coming in and out of the meeting, and it's strange. So we have the March 4th special meeting minutes, the February 26th, 2020 regular meeting minutes, the warrant approval from January, February 2020, and the Salem EMS warrant approval of 2020. So we should vote to approve this. I guess I'm not going to wait around to hear a motion or things. So. I'm going to call on Everett first. Yes or no?
Yes.
Myself, I'll vote yes. Chris?
Yes.
Gail?
Yes.
And Kyle?
Aye.
Okay, great. So that's Nathan unanimous. And now we move to our operations report, and we're very happy to have Pam Hudson's superintendent back with us. Thank you, Pam. And just also a reminder for everybody to mute their microphones. We're just getting a lot of background noise. Pam?
Great. Thank you. I am happy to be back also. I'm sorry I had to miss the February meeting, but it was unavoidable. I have, for this meeting, I have caught up on the January reports and also the February reports, and I sent out all of them to the commissioners, so you've got a lot of paperwork to catch up on that. In January, I'm just going to give a kind of a little synopsis of January, and then since you have received all of them, then you can ask questions from that, and then I'll move on to February, if that's okay. Okay, for January, that's the month that we usually have the lowest amount of property taxes that come in. We only had $3,099. And then we had a prior year refund, a $791.97 that came in. So our total January receipts were only $3,890.97. But our disbursements in January are always more because we pay a lot of things up front in January. And so we had $36,334.52 of accounts payables. And we did have one public records request, and it costs us about $500 to review with the attorney. So that brings our total to one for January. And if you look at your financial reports, the synopsis, the one with the revenue and expenditures by fund, I also included all of our line items there for the start of January. I didn't suppress any that didn't have zero amount so that you could have every line item that we have and the budgeted amount to start with. So that's why it was a little bit longer than normal, but I thought it was important for you to see all the line items to begin with for that. Did anyone have any questions about the financials on January? No? Okay. Great. So back in January, as far as operationally, we had our first special meeting on January 2nd, where all the commissioners were finally together, and that was nice. We also scheduled our regularly scheduled board meeting for January 22nd happened, and ahead of that was a work session with Richard Davis that that the commissioners, they have to, the new ones have to have a class on the OP, on the Open Public Meetings Act and the public records request. And so we took care of that at that first meeting. They have to get that done within 3 months of getting in their office. And then we also, in January, that's the month where we go over the Code of Ethics and each commissioner reviews it and signs, and we put that on our website that all of the commissioners have reviewed it. And then there were committee assignments that happened for the year. So we have 9 committees, and so we assigned commissioners for that so that we know who to go to during the course of the month for anything. And that was about what happened in January. Anybody have anything you want to add or questions since I was not available?
You know, this is Everett. I have one question. I'm curious about the public, about the records request, only because I wonder if we failed to do something. So.
Yeah. We did not fail to do anything. The record request that came in was very vague. It was about wanting some of our audit reports, which all of our audit reports by the Washington State Auditors, they're all public, so you can go onto their site, type in our name, and pull them up. But the request was very vague, and we didn't understand. They needed and things like that. So yeah. That's a lesson for if you are going to make a public records request, to try to make it very detailed and so that we know exactly what we need to supply for your request.
Pam,
I have a question, Pam, about. Oh, sorry.
Sure.
Pam, it's Trish. Are we allowed to know who requested made the public records request? Is that for public information?
Yes, it is.
Can you tell us?
I don't know. I don't know particular. Okay. Nathan would know. He holds. He's the public records officer.
Okay.
So he has
curious.
That list.
Yeah.
Normally, if I was in my normal course of business, I would have that information, but
I was just curious. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So, are we finished with January?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. February, we got a little bit more in property tax revenues. we had $13,531 in, and we had leasehold tax that came in of $1,961.47. So our total receipts were $15,492.77. And disbursements wise, in February, we only had $7,970.83, which that started being a time where I had to be out. Things started happening with the coronavirus, things pulling up, and the wages for myself and Nathan were not paid to EMS during that month. They pushed to March, so they didn't show up there, so it made it seem like it was, you know, very, very low disbursement month. We didn't have any public records requests, and we, on the revenue expenditures and the fund report, there was a mistake with the county on paying our medical insurance. We changed from Kaiser to Regents, and when we did that, we had to pay 2 months ahead. You always have to pay a month ahead for your insurance. And that was supposed to happen in January, which it did. But then in February, and then again in March, it still got charged double again. So that's why the medical part seems so high right now. So we'll go 2 months, and the county will not charge anything for the staff medical. That's me, Nathan, and on the EMS desk side too. So that's why that medical line seems so high that way. Did you have any questions about February's expenses or revenues? Operationally, the auditors came back from February 6th to the 8th. They were there 3 days. They finished what they needed on site, and then they took everything back to the Bellingham office and worked on finishing it. And we did have our exit conference in March, middle of March, and quarterback more on that next, well, in 2 weeks. And the Integration Steering Committee, because of all the COVID preparations and things of that and stay at home, that they had a meeting on February 24th, but since then that's been put on hold. And Beth Williams-Giger gave the Peace Health 6 month report. That was for the period of July 1st, 2019 to December 31st, 2019. And then we have approved that subsidy payment to Peace Health. It doesn't show yet on our cash balance because at the county working from home, there's delays there too. So the $511,294.01, that'll come out next month, but that is anticipated. That happens every year at this time. And then, as you know, then all of the coronavirus things started heating up towards the end of February, and Kyle Dodd informed us of when the EOC started, and dealing mostly with that during our everyday work and other things being put on hold. So, do you have any questions about February?
I don't. Thank you, Pam.
Okay.
Can I say, though, that a thank you to you and to Chief Kutzing regarding our audit.
that did happen in March, and I know we're not technically talking about that, but it's been really great to see in the 2 years the improvements that have happened and been acknowledged as part of our audit reports. And so thanks goes to you and to Carl, and also people. I mean, EMS has been through quite a few people. I think back to Tina Heilman and the hard work she did organizing things there, and you know, Heather carrying on the work now, and Chris, you know, and his support. So anyway, thank you to you all. I really appreciate that things are looking good. Yeah. All right, if that wraps it up, I think we hand things over to Chief Kutzing.